Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I talk about the final week of Parliament's summer term and the future of the Labour Party, as ever, with George Eaton and Stephen Bush. Then I'm joined by Stephen Bush again and Caroline Crampton to talk about motherhood and politics, following up from my cover story this week. Now, it might be the last week of the parliamentary year, but there's been no stopping MPs with all kinds of huge legislation on, well, huge rows, really, I think we should probably say, and the Labour leadership contest taking an unexpected turn with the news that Jeremy Corbyn might be on course to win. I'm joined by George Eaton, our politics editor, and Stephen Bush, editor of The Staggers, to talk about it in Parliament this week. So it was a bad week for the government, wasn't it, really?
Yes, well, they, of course, had to abandon the vote they were planning to amend the Fox Hunting Act in response to the SNP's decision that they would vote on that, and that would have meant a defeat. And what that was a reminder of is just how difficult it is to govern with a majority of 12. I mean, here we are supposedly in the honeymoon period for the government. They've already had to pull votes on hunting, on English rates or English laws, and abandon, for now, their plan to replace the Human Rights Act with a British Bill of Rights.
Wasn't that a bit of an... I mean, we've talked a lot about sort of traps and George Osborne setting traps. Do you think that that vote on fox hunting was in some ways, although it's a short-term humiliation for the government, a trap for the SNP? Because they've broken their principle that they would abstain on English-only matters.
Yes, I think that's one possible interpretation, although I think the SNP are in quite a strong position on this because most people in England don't want the Hunting Act changed. So one of the arguments Nicola Sturgeon made for her U-turn was we are forming progressive alliances with people in England who want a progressive majority or at least a significant minority in Parliament to act in their favour.
That's very convenient, isn't it? We would normally abstain, but actually I've definitely had a lot of letters about this one issue. But yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I want to come to the Labour leadership now. Mm. So, George, in your column this week, you wrote about the backlash at the Parliamentary Labour Party meeting at the start of the week against Harriet Harman's decision that she wouldn't vote against all the budget measures on welfare reforms. It got quite testy. There was a great description of the policy, the two-child policy, being reminiscent of Mao Zedong and King Herod.
Yes.
So I can imagine there was sort of blood on the walls after that meeting.
Yes, I mean, Harriet Harman and Chris Leslie, in the wake of the budget, made it immediately clear that Labour, as they saw it, wouldn't fall into the trap of opposing everything. And they don't want to do what they did in 2010, because they think that just makes you look like a party of protest rather than a responsible opposition that could eventually form a government. So, for instance, they said they wouldn't oppose the public sector pay cap of 1%, that they would support the benefit cap, even though it's been significantly reduced. But the tipping point came when Harriet Harman said in an interview on the Sunday Politics that she would not oppose the two-child limits on tax credits, meaning that if you have a third child, you won't receive child tax credits for them. And that was a sort of a radioactive sort of explosion in the party, really. That because for Labour MPs, yeah, so as the language you were referring to suggests, this is a sort of visceral issue. Mm. That they think it really is immoral rather than just unwise what the Conservatives are doing.
It was made for a very interesting PMQs yesterday. So Harriet Harman was standing in, obviously. There were beckons from the Tory MPs kind of saying, like, join us, obviously quite enjoying her discomfort. And then I thought it was very interesting, the SNP's Angus Robertson, who now gets a couple of questions, he said, he brought up the idea about the fact that if you have a third child through rape, then you have to kind of basically go down to the job centre and personally prove to Ian Duncan Smith that something untoward happened, when we know that rape is a hugely underreported and under-prosecuted crime. And I thought it was quite interesting to see the SNP kind of, basically both sides revelling in Labour's discomfort. So the SNP from the left and the Tories from the right. But talking about being caught between left and right, see what I did there, Stephen. The Labour leadership, I keep hearing from people in Labour kind of disbelief that it's all gone bonkers. They really didn't foresee that having Jeremy Corbyn on the ballot was anything more than a kind of sort of pity move that would let him sort of say a few things about the Iraq war and be a totally marginalised figure. That's not what's happened, is it, at all?
No. There was a general orthodoxy within the PLP and within the high commands of two out of the three other candidates that effectively it was like, well, you've had your fun. You've had your 5 years of going, oh, let's go a little bit to the left. It's ended in disaster. Now you're going to come back to the centre. Which in some ways actually was the same miscalculation that underpinned the whole Ed Miliband strategy. It was 5 years of thinking the country would return gratefully to Labour. And obviously that hasn't happened. The party has moved in Ed Miliband's direction and meant much of it seems to feel that he lost because he was insufficiently anti-austere. There is also another aspect, I think, to what's going on at the moment, which is that the party isn't convinced that either of the other three can win. So the kind of Paul Flynn left, who's one MP in the Commons, who's never really voted for Tony Blair in day-to-day votes, but voted for him in the leadership, voted for David Miliband and has endorsed Liz Kendall. That bit of the left, which is willing to vote for the right if it thinks it can win, is not convinced in the country by any of the three candidates from the Labour right. Someone texted me yesterday saying, well, I figured if we're going to go down, we might as well go down in flames. which
is slightly alarming.
Yeah, but I think, you know, ultimately you can sort of see the attraction. If your thinking is, well, we'll lose with Yvette Cooper because she's married to Ed Bald and she's not very interesting. We'll lose with Liz Kendall because she's not the finished product and you're not going to become the finished product in the bear pit of being leader of the opposition, and we're not going to win with Andy Burnham because the Sun hates him, then it's reasonable to look at Jeremy Corbyn at that point and go, well, we're not going to win, but at least I wouldn't be upset by any of it.
Is that, George, you think a kind of touch of the Ian Duncan Smith? Is that how Ian Duncan Smith ended up leader of the Tory party?
Yes, it is, and it's about choosing ideological purity over political pragmatism and who's most likely to become prime minister. And in the same way that you now have Liz Kendall and Harriet Harman described as Tories, basically, for supporting some austerity, which, of course, was the position under Ed Miliband, just less explicitly.
SNP attacking them, when the SNP's election manifesto was actually in some ways more, whatever the word is, either fiscally prudent or austere, depending on your point of view, than Labour's.
Yes, and the SNP does make it more difficult for Labour to move closer to the centre, undoubtedly, because you now have a party that, as you say, deploys left-wing rhetoric very effectively in a way you didn't have before. The Lib Dems under Nick Clegg had, of course, become a very moderate centrist party, and they weren't. And now you have the SNP almost playing the role that the Lib Dems played under Charles Kennedy, or it's like having sort of multiple George Galloways in the chamber. It does make it much more difficult.
And I want to turn finally to the Lib Dem leadership, which is on the verge of, as we record this, on the verge of being announced, possibly has been announced by the time you're listening to this. I'm going to put my hat on the floor. No, that's not a metaphor, but whatever. I'm going to say Tim Farron looks to be, unless polling really, we might as well just all give up and just look at the entrails of a goat, would have him as a leader. What's in his intray? What does he need to do, Stephen, to recover from the most amazing shellacking that any political party has had in living memory?
Well, he sort of needs to set out a unique reason to vote for the Liberal Democrats at the next election, whether that is to pitch as the we are the party which can beat the Tories in the southwest and Cornwall, whether that is the, because ultimately they campaigned themselves into the ground last time and they were crushed. Boundary changes will make it harder for them next time, and the Tories want to gobble up those last remaining eight. So yeah, basically they need to set out a reason to exist.
Is there a danger, George, that from people that I talk to, you know, people like Tim Farron, he's very well respected and well regarded, that the concern is often that is he too much of a social democrat rather than a liberal? And that kind of, A, parks tanks on Labour's lawn, but B, if you are going to look at a reason why you'd have the Lib Dems, look at the ways in which Labour is often quite illiberal, you know, quite statist. And that's where the votes are for the Lib Dems. Mm.
Well, I think obviously there has been a lot of arguments and tension over his socially conservative voting record. I don't think that will be an issue sort of once he's leader, because he has sort of made several mea culpas about that. And of course, these issues are not sort of particularly live ones in British politics at the moment. But you're right that yes, he is a social democrat on economic policy, which potentially does allow him to outflank Labour from the left on some issues, because the view among MPs is still that whether it's Andy Burnham or Yvette Cooper or Jeremy Corbyn excluded, they will take a more centrist position on business and on the economy than Ed Miliband did. And then, of course, there are the civil liberties issues, and he is passionate on civil liberties and constitutional reform and climate change. Those are the distinctive issues that he'll have to embrace and make a lot of noise about if the Lib Dems are to get heard and to be seen as relevant.
And if there is a vote on further action on extending our airstrikes into Syria, and maybe even I'm sure, who knows what special forces do, but, you know, kind of ground troops in Syria, do you think that that's something that under Tim Fran the Lib Dems would oppose?
I think they would support it. I mean, I think Tim Farron supported the airstrikes in Iraq against ISIS. Most now accept the argument that it doesn't make sense to respect what is now an artificial border between Iraq and Syria when ISIS is on the march. But it's a good test. I mean, there will be votes in opposing it. And so it is a test of Tim Farron's sort of political principle, whether he will go for an early tactical victory. I think there are lots of other issues that he could benefit from protesting on. I think it would be unwise to pick that one.
And finally, Stephen, if Jeremy Corbyn did get elected Labour leader, how long do you think he would last as Labour leader?
I mean, I'm going to caveat this first by saying I think it's unlikely. I think that he has a chance of coming first in the first round, but there are no second preferences in their preferential voting system, I think, for Corbyn. I actually think he'd probably last at least till 2018, and probably for the full whack. Labour doesn't get rid of its leaders, and ultimately the reason why they're in this mess is because 11 of their parliamentary party were too scared of their activists not to go, no, I don't want him on the ballot, he's a loser. Like, the reason why you have Yvette and Andy going, oh, well, let's move a bit to the left and not tackling him, is because the parliamentary party is scared of Labour activists. And that will not change.
But isn't that the problem? I mean, I think I was talking yesterday about the exactly the same thing happening with the Republican Party in the US, that you basically have a selectorate versus an electorate problem. So you have the Republican Party primaries where they just debate with each other, and now I think there are suggestions there that they would like to see people debating across the parties. So it becomes a kind of contest about who can say the meanest things about abortion, who can say the nicest things about guns, who can, you know, wear most flag pins on their lapel. And then they kind of get through that process, and it's, you know, it absolutely battered Mitt Romney last time. You come out of that, and then you have to go, okay, well, that's done. Now, here I am, I'm going to have to appeal to, you know, Hispanic voters when I've been incredibly hardline on immigration up until now, say. Is a version of that happening in the Labour Party?
Yes, I think there is the slightly unnerving thing for Labour is that, as, you know, pensioners who 20 years ago were voting for, you know, as 40-somethings were voting for Tony Blair by 20 points, are now voting for the Conservatives by 30 points. The only demographic which voted for them last time were 18 to 24-year-olds who don't vote, and in any case were the only demographic they were offering a tax cut to in the shape of a tuition fee haircut. So it is rather bleak for them on that score, and you do have a movement that, you know, for many good reasons, does want full-throated opposition to austerity, full-throated opposition to the further rounds of cuts. Yeah, I think it may be at the moment that it is impossible to marry the desires of Labour's base with the votes they need to win a general election, and it may not be for some time.
And finally, George, I want to just check in with the deputy leader race. We haven't heard so much about that for obvious reasons. It's not quite such a high-profile contest. Is there anything interesting happening there? I mean, are people being asked, could you work with Jeremy Corbyn for a start?
Well, one reason we haven't heard too much about it is that the view among MPs is that it is now a shoo-in for Tom Watson. And Tom Watson was quite politically smart early on in defining the job as a campaigning role and saying, I am sort of the man for this. And he toured a huge number of constituencies during the general election campaign. And he identified this quite a while ago as the job he wanted. And so he does have a huge amount of support among activists for those reasons, and of course his crusade against Rupert Murdoch and News Corporation,
which is something I think is interesting. If you say that you know, the odds still suggest that Andy Burnham is the favourite. So you're going to end up with a top two in Labour, both of whom have taken very explicitly anti-Murdoch positions. Now, while I'm sure that will absolutely delight many people on the left, it is an electoral problem, so I'm sure we will return to that. But for the moment, I'll say thank you very much to Stephen and George. I've written this week's cover story, which is about the twin ways in which women face discrimination in politics. If they are mothers, they obviously have to have time out for maternity leave, and it's often very difficult for them to come back. Whereas if they're single, they're often attacked in the press, and it's assumed that...
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Voters won't want somebody who has nothing else in their life, as it's often framed. I'm joined by Stephen Bush and Caroline Crampton to talk a little bit more about this. Stephen, you obviously talk to a lot of MPs. How hard do you think that they find it to juggle family life? How unfamily friendly is Westminster?
I think exceptionally so. And actually, depressingly, it's got worse since 2009, since the expenses scandal, because there was a period under New Labour, and I'll let you talk about like some of the stuff you talked about Patricia Hewitt with in a bit, where they tried to change things and that made things better for a lot of people. Since the expenses scandal, one of the rules Ipswich introduced is you can only claim for a one-bedroom flat. Which basically means if you are not a London MP, you cannot live with your children in London anymore. The life than, say, Yvette Cooper or Patricia Hewitt, the MP, Liz Kendall's predecessor in Leicester West have, where they could live with their families in London, is not one which is available if you are, say, Nicky Morgan, the new MP for Loughborough, or Liz Kendall, or, say, Alison McGovern, the MP for Wirral South. Yeah, those MPs cannot, even if they... And obviously some MPs want to live at home. Yeah, they are the MPs where they grew up or, you know, yeah, for one reason or other, they live full-time in the constituency. But they cannot even have the option of bringing their children with them now.
I think that was one of the things I was sort of surprised because, you know, you kind of assume, you know, in a kind of glib level that obviously all MPs work in two places. And particularly now, people are very hot on the idea that they don't want their MP just to be somebody who's totally Westminster-based and who kind of calls in and sort of goes, oh, how charming, what lovely rockery, and then leaves again. So, yeah, you have this situation where in 97, these 101 female Labour MPs turned up and they all said, oh, God, we're gonna overhaul the working hours. This is one of the things that, you know, is a really easy thing to change to make workplaces more family-friendly. Then they had discovered, exactly like you say, this kind of two-tier system where the problem was that all the ones who could get home to their families every night wanted essentially a normal working day. They wanted 9 to 5. But the ones who were never going to see their families anyway wanted a late start on Monday so they could have the weekend in their constituency and then come up and an early finish on Thursday. They wanted to compress their work. And one of the things that's been a great success for making workplaces more family-friendly is more kind of flexible working. More, you know, teleconferencing, more working from home, more people working, job sharing, things like that, all of which are really hard to jam into the Westminster system. So Patricia Hewitt, for it, tells this great story about how she wanted to have a job sharing junior minister. And she suggested this to Tony Blair and he went, job sharing? What's that? And Jonathan Powell, his chief of staff, went, yeah, it's when two people share a job. and then they were quite up for it at that point, but it never quite happened. But there's a suggestion that, I mean, the Lib Dems want to get back on the table, the idea of talking about job-sharing MPs. They think the only thing that would be a problem would be voting. What do you do about that? You know, you have an idea that you have an MP who is accountable. But there are ways of looking at it. I want to talk to you, Caroline, about the cover, because it's been quite a provocative cover. What was your first reaction when you saw it? So just for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's Nicola Sturgeon, Theresa May, Liz Kendall and Angela Merkel looking at a crib, but instead of a baby in the crib, there's a ballot box.
I really liked it when I first saw it. I thought, as a cover is supposed to be, it's a sort of eye-catching representation of what the piece is about, you know. So, and it's by the drawing, the painting is done by David Young, who does quite a lot of our covers. It's in his sort of quite distinctive style, and I thought it was great. And then when it went on the internet yesterday afternoon, a whole new dimension was discovered by our readers, in which they sort of seemed to be blaming us for the problem that you're pointing out. There was quite a lot of, well, specifically you, Helen. It's all your fault. Sexism in politics, your fault.
But this is, because it's something that, obviously we thought about it a lot. And one of the things that, I was very alert to the idea that anything that we depicted female politicians doing would attract accusations of sexism. Mm. And actually the comeback to that was, well, hang on a minute. Anybody who's seen our covers will know that we have, kind of Nick Clegg being buried up to his neck in sand, or
Nigel Farage wearing a Victorian bathing suit, they're caricatures. This isn't a caricature, even. They're just women standing there.
And there's actually this sort of weird thing where if you treated female politicians as badly as we treat male politicians and took the mick as much as we do in our covers about them, people would see that as sexist, which I think is a really difficult thing. But yeah, as you say, the one overriding response was, why are you making this just about women? Why is it always questions about women?
But it is about women. The cover line is the motherhood trap, and your whole piece makes this point that this double bind that women find themselves in does not happen to men. Men do not sort of get flack for either having children or not having children. If they have children, it's a useful prop for them to have in photo shoots or on campaign trail. If they don't, there's no stigma to that. They're just professional men doing their jobs.
Yeah, I thought Ben Bradshaw was really interesting. So he's running for the deputy leader, and I know that Kezia Dugdale, who's running for Scottish leader, and Stella Creasy, who's running for Labour deputy leader, have been faced with these sort of whispers about the kind of, Stella Creasy, when she was running for Walthamstow, her Tory opponent put out a leaflet with her qualifications on that said, has worked in a supermarket, wife, mother, understands you. And then the list under Stella was has career politician, understands Ed Miliband. So the implicit rebuke was that by not being a wife and a mother, this was evidence of her not being a normal human being. So I put that press question to Ben Bradshaw, and he went, oh no, it's never really been raised at Mincemeat. And he said, and which I thought was a really and quite a beautiful thing to say. He said, me and the man that I've been with for 20 years, we don't have children, but we do have a family. Everyone's got parents, everyone's got nieces and nephews. They might have extended family, people they consider to be family, even though they're not genetically related. And he actually, he cared for his mum when she had Alzheimer's when he was a teenager. So men do experience caring responsibilities, but there is that particular feeling that motherhood or not defines women's lives in a way that it doesn't. Mm. But there are fathers now, Stephen, aren't there, in the Commons, who are quite new men.
Yeah, there are sort of lots of hands-on dads in the Commons. And again, they tend to be in the 2010 intake, so they tend to be the ones who actually are also struggling with this one-bed flat policy. But even so, the stat I thought was most arresting in the piece is the one about the shadow cabinet, which I assume we've done because there is a roughly equal number of men and women. Of the 14 men in the shadow cabinet, they have 31 children between them. Of the 13 women between them, they have 16 children between them. I am childless, so I'm going to feel free to offend all of the other childless people listening to the podcast. I assume it would be harder to do my job well if I also had to look after a small human being. What that stat says to me is that clearly the second you make it even a little bit harder for women to get to the top, even in the Labour Party, it suddenly becomes near impossible. And there's still this thing with, new model dads, as it were, and people kind of go, oh, isn't he doing well? Isn't he special? Like it's almost trendy, really.
He's doing almost half the work. Yeah. And then it's kind of like, I think that's really interesting because you can say, well, you're cherry picking, and obviously there are very high profile mothers. Yvette Cooper has got three children. She's in a Labour leadership race. But the overall stat is that 45% of women in the Commons don't have children, and it's 28% of men. Now, some of those people might go on to in the future. Actually, if you look at the current average, it's about 1 in 5 women will get to the age of 45 without having children. So there's definitely, even taking into account that some MPs will be younger than that, there's definitely it's affecting women in a way that it's not affecting men. And the other thing that's interesting is that women tend to wait until their children are older before they go into politics. So I think that there is a movement in the Tory party, particularly, that they think that the way to solve this may be to ask more women to look into politics as a second career, something that you do in your 50s. The problem with that is that this is why reaching the top is important, is that that's not where leaders come from now. Very rarely do you get a British political party leader who turns up and first elected at the age of 60. It's just not how it works. So that leadership track is broken for women because for example, Rachel Reeves, who possibly might have run for the Labour deputy leadership is currently on maternity leave. It just has fallen that way.
We were talking just the other day about who might have been an alternative candidate from the left of the Labour Party instead of Jeremy Corbyn, and the name that came up was Lisa Nandy, apart from she's just had a baby, so she's just not there at the right time.
Yeah,
when and the nominations could have happened.
Might not win this time, who I think would certainly have crushed all opposition last time around, didn't run because her children were younger, and she would easily, I think, have beaten either Miliband.
But then it was deemed to be not, she needed to be around when they were young, but not her husband, which is a
her husband
of,
ran last time.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, obviously we can't comment on how people are free to structure their parental arrangements however they see fit, but I think you do have to zoom out and look at it at a structural level.
It's so interesting, the bit I really was intrigued by, the bit in your piece where you talked to Jo Swinson about, and she, like Yvette Cooper in her balls, her husband was in Parliament at the same time as her, and they had a small baby, and they managed to get the rules changed for voting. You can now walk through a voting lobby holding a baby. But they used him to get that changed rather than her.
So he was the first one to take their son through. I thought what was interesting also about Jo Swinson's experience was the fact that they provided a kind of perfect control, you've got a kind of control group as well as a study group, because she said that people expected there'd be times they wouldn't be able to get hold of her. They didn't expect that for Duncan. And I think that's one of the things that when I talk to women who are trying to match up a kind of career, is that all the pressure, and everyone around you assumes that it will fall more heavily on a woman, and that's actually kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So she also talks about the fact that on maternity leave, you know, you learn how to do a lot of things, and this is something that, you know, my family have said to me as well, you know, you become the one who does the admin for the child. And then it's very hard to hand that all over. Actually, someone else I spoke to, who didn't go in the piece, said, also, the other thing is a lot of women don't want to hand it over. They feel that they will be very harshly judged if they do, and that they don't quite trust their partner not to leave a child, you know, in a supermarket or something like that, but these are really strong social forces that shape people's behaviours, you know, and then because they're so strong, they seem natural. Hmm. So I know, I've got a female friend who's, she and her husband both work, and actually he was freelancing, so he was more free to do stuff, but the teachers at school would still send notes home for her. You know, would you give this to your wife? Like, he was sort of, you know, he was just a kind of deputy. And that's what the research shows. A great book I read last year called Overwhelmed said that women tend to be more often the supervising parent, and men get to be the kind of fun parent. Mm. So they come in for a couple of hours of babysitting, but they're not in overall control, essentially. Stephen, do you think it will get better?
I'm innately pessimistic. I think if, you know, hopefully Labour will get its act together, the Tories may lose the next election or at least lose their majority. If they're dependent on Lib Dems and votes from outside, it's the kind of thing which will happen. I think the other point that Jo Swinson makes in your piece about shared maternity leave, one MP pointed out to me, and the thing she said, well, the thing you forget is that in the first 9 months, everyone has this thing that the person who has to work sleeps. Hmm. So you get into this pattern in the first 9 months of one of you gets up when the person cries. Now, when you both go back to work, then either that doesn't change or the other one has to learn how to quiet her.
And that's something that's in Sheryl Sandberg's book as well, Lean In, which is the idea that if you go it, because of the way that the pay gap works and the way that women are encouraged towards lower paid work, more casual work, we know that there are more women in part-time work, then if you go into having the baby and one of your salaries is already lower, then that's the one it's also easier to sacrifice. Mm. And you can say all you want, you know, when men and women work in the same jobs, the pay gap is now diminishing. The fact is that very often that they don't. And there's a great line that I think Simon Cooper once wrote in the FT, which is, you know, the fastest way to reduce the wages in any sector is to feminize it. So if you have a profession that is traditionally male and is quite high status, therefore quite high work pay, if huge numbers of women come into that, then actually the floor tends to drop out of it. And that's just the way that it works. I was quite pessimistic too, Stephen, when I came out of this, because I think there is... What was interesting about it for me is I'm sure some people will say, well, this is just, you know, 650 people who are all quite, you know, 67 grand a year, why should we really care? But actually, it applies all the way down the job scale. And as jobs become more insecure, as you get more things like zero-hours contracts, fewer people get employment protection. If we leave the EU, you know, you might get very well get things like maternity leave rights might come under a lot of stress. all of those things make it much easier to hire somebody who doesn't have children, who isn't encumbered by caring responsibilities. Mm. And as there is no current way to fund all the elderly care that needs to happen, that's going to fall on a whole new set of people who are going to have yet more unpaid labour that's demanded of them. So that was pretty bleak.
Yeah. but you should read the piece anyway.
Yeah, if only just to be more accurately and statistically backed in your depression about these things. Thanks very much, Caroline and Stephen. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.